Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk World Radio, we are discussing Israelgate, Nord Stream, and a near miss on World War III. Our guest, journalist James Bamford, has a new book called Spy Fail: Foreign Spies, Moles, Saboteurs, and the Collapse of America's Counterintelligence. And he has recent articles in The Nation magazine, one called The Candidate and the Spy, another, The Nord Stream Explosions, New Revelations About Motive, Means, and Opportunity. Let's start with The Candidate and the Spy. The U.S. government, as I understand it, did an investigation of Russiagate and came up pretty much empty, but it seems there was an Israelgate there documented by that investigation, but not reported out by it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. The Russiagate investigation went on for several years and came up pretty much empty-handed. I mean, there was no question that Russia eavesdropped and stole emails from the Clinton campaign. But what the Russiagate investigation was about was to see if there was collusion between the Russian government and the Trump campaign. And they found that there was no collusion. But during that same time that they were looking into collusion within the 2016 election, they did find that there was an Israeli agent that came to the United States and got involved with the Trump administration, the Trump campaign. So there's no question about that, because what I came up with, it was under the Freedom of Information Act. There were documents that were released. And it was a search warrant by the FBI, including an affidavit that pretty much laid out how this was taking place.
So your information came from the FBI, but the FBI wasn't publicly trumpeting it itself.
Well, these were I guess they call them secret they weren't made public. I mean, these were affidavits and a search warrant that was kept secret at the time. Again, it was only released under the Freedom of Information Act, so it wasn't the FBI didn't come out and say, "Oh, we have this." They were sort of forced to release it under the Freedom of Information Act, and they redacted the name of the particular individual that came over, the secret agent. They took his name out of it. It's redacted, but those were the document. Those were the that was the information they were after. They were after that person's communications. They went to Google and so forth to try to get his emails and so forth. So it was a very serious investigation. The problem is, when the Mueller documents came out and the Senate Intelligence Committee came out, they had all that information redacted.
Do you know if that was a Senate Intelligence Committee decision or an FBI or Justice Department decision?
No, it was, I would assume it was the Senate Intelligence Committee's decision. The FBI or the administration or whatever may have had some say in it, but it was certainly the decision of the Intelligence Committee. So in other words, the entire U.S. government wanted to keep this under wraps, and the only way it came out was through a search warrant. But this was one search warrant, one affidavit. Presumably, the government has a great deal more information, because if they found out that there was this agent who was sent by Prime Minister Netanyahu, and the documents actually say PM numerous times in there, and the FBI writes PM stands for the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu.
And so what did Israel provide to the Trump for President campaign? Sure.
Nobody in the United States, including the U.S. government, knew that the Russians were eavesdropping on Hillary Clinton and taking her emails, as well as a DNC. So the Israeli intelligence organization, Unit 8200, which is the equivalent of NSA, they were able to get that information. And what they wanted to do was to provide it to the Trump campaign as sort of a quid pro quo. So early in May of 2016, the secret agent came over to the United States and told one of the key players in the Trump campaign, Roger Stone, that they had done this, that they had gotten this information. The FBI was able to determine this because they did a search of the internet, the emails that were coming out of Roger Stone's computer, for example. And they found that in early May, the same day he met with the and talked to the Israeli agent, he began Googling things like Lucifer 2.0 and so forth. These were only names that came out a month later in the United States because Lucifer was a cover name for the Russians who were hacking into the Clinton campaign and the DNC. So in other words, how could Roger Stone have been Googling these names? Again, the same day he has contact with the Israeli agent, a month before anybody, including the U.S. government, has any knowledge of the Russian hacking into the Clinton campaign. So it's a very complex operation, but that's what happened. The Israelis, or Netanyahu personally, sent an agent over, met with Roger Stone, said, here's what we have. We have intelligence that is very valuable intelligence on Hillary Clinton, and we're willing to provide it for you. What we want in return is some favors from Trump if he gets elected. And one of those key things was to have Trump recognize Jerusalem as being the sole possession, basically, of Israel. In other words, not negotiated between the Israelis and the Palestinians. So that was the push all through the summer when they were having these meetings. And finally, in September, after a very quiet private meeting in Trump's townhouse or his penthouse in New York, between Trump and Netanyahu, Trump came out and said that very thing, that he would, if he's elected president, recognize Jerusalem as being the capital of sole capital of Israel. And he did that. He moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem when he became president. So that was sort of a fait accompli. The information was passed to the Trump campaign, and Trump agreed to do the recognition of Jerusalem.
And another, I believe, was to tear up the nuclear deal with Iran, and he did that one too, right?
Well, he did that. He had already done that. He'd already made that decision and made that announcement before all this happened. I think he made it maybe a month before this happened, but that was obviously another thing that was a reason that Netanyahu wanted Trump in the White House was because of his agreement to tear up the Iran accord. And so Netanyahu had two choices here. They were able to find out that Russia was eavesdropping on the US campaign on Hillary Clinton. Now, you know, it's an ally. They get $4 billion a year from the American taxpayers. The logical thing to do and the right thing to do would be if you find out that, you know, our adversary is stealing all this these emails and so forth from a Democratic candidate, to tell the sitting president, to tell Obama about this. But what they did was, instead of doing that, they told the opponent, the Republican candidate, which again should make everybody outraged that it wasn't the Russians interfering, it was the Israelis interfering. But the Russians, everybody was going after, and Israel, nobody wants to talk about. So,
but whether it was the Russians, as everybody thinks, or Israel, or this sort of combination of Israel piggybacking on the Russian spying, there isn't any implication that it actually affected the outcome of the election, is there?
No, that really wasn't the intention. The intention was not to, you know, get the American public to necessarily vote for for Trump. It was to get Trump, if he's elected president, to do the bidding of Netanyahu. I mean, that was the whole idea. The whole idea was to, you know, they didn't have any power to make Trump president, but they did have a power to make him agree to a position that the Israelis wanted.
And it's rather powerful case that Israel has influence not just over Trump, but over the entire U.S. government, in that the whole establishment invested all this effort in this Russiagate investigation and then found their smoking gun in the work of Israel and then clammed up and said not a word about it.
And they still say nothing about it. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the information is there. I only have, you know, a small portion of it. I mean, it's an extremely damning portion. It's the actual search warrant, plus it's the affidavit. And anybody can get this. It's there on the internet. It's there released by the Justice Department. This isn't some guy I met in the back of a parking lot who told me this stuff. This isn't, you know, my information. I'm a researcher. I don't have a lot of, you know, sources in parking lots and all that. Back of parking garages. So I get a lot of my information from Freedom of Information Act, and that's what this is. And anybody could go in my book. I have the back note on it, and all you have to do is click it, and you can read the documents yourself. It's not, this isn't something that's, you know, somebody that was handed to me out the back door of NSA or something. It's a public document. It was released under FOIA. So anybody could read it, but that's what it says. It says that the Netanyahu sent over a intelligence agent, a spy, to undermine the election.
We're speaking with James Bamford, and you have another incredible recent article about Nord Stream. And speaking of going after publicly available information rather than sources in garages, you have a different take from the report that came out from Seymour Hersh. You seem to document primarily that Ukraine and Poland had the desire and the capability to have done this, right?
Yeah, there's been, I've known Cy Hirsch for 40 years or whatever, you know, we're friends, but I didn't buy into that story that he wrote because it was so weakly sourced and parts of it just didn't seem to make much sense. There would have been more coming out, or there should have been more coming out than what he wrote. It was very weakly sourced, and it was not, you know,
well,
when
was
you do
one unnamed person, right? As far as we know, one unnamed person. Right?
Yeah, one unnamed person who seemed to know everything, that was going on. So, I don't meet sources like that very often that know everything from secret meetings in the executive office building or whatever, down to what the divers were doing down under the sea and all that stuff. So anyway, I do my own research. And so there were a number of indications that this was Ukraine that was behind it. First of all, 4 days after the explosion, the German magazine Der Spiegel came out with a report that the U.S. government, I think it was NSA, I guess, had picked up intercepts from Russia, where Russia was warning, sending an internal warning that the Ukrainians were planning to do some sabotage against some Western targets. And then there were more indications that were coming out from other leaks that were coming out from the Europeans in terms of pointing the finger at Ukraine. So there were a number of sources pointing to Ukraine up until this point. So what I did was, but these reports didn't really do any background into what the capabilities, the means, motive, and opportunity was for Ukraine. And that's what I did. So I looked at the motive, and they had certainly a motive. The Russians were sending a lot of oil through a pipeline going through Ukraine, and it also went through Poland. And so they were making a lot of money on the transit fees of the oil going through. A lot of that would have been would have ended when they created the Nord Stream pipeline. Plus, they looked at that as a as almost an act of war. I mean, they basically called it an act of war, that pipeline, because in addition to taking their money away from them, it was going to create a situation where Europe was very dependent on Russia. And so it would give Russia a lot of ability to get whatever they wanted from the Europeans, and to become, the Europeans become dependent on Russia. And that was the opposite of what the Ukrainians wanted. So the Ukrainians were very much against this. I looked into some of these documents that came out of the Ukrainian intelligence service, and they were adamant that this not happen, that this pipeline not be built.
Is Russia paying transit fees to Ukraine while waging a war against Ukraine and being sanctioned for waging that war?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know whether they're actually doing that or not right now. Well, let me get into one other point here. The other country that was looked like it was fairly heavily involved was Poland, for example, because Poland had the same viewpoint. They were getting transit fees from Russian gas going through their country. Plus, they had the same fears of Russia. They had a hatred of Russia, and they had the same fears that Russia was going to become very good friends with Europe and so forth, or at least Europe would become dependent on them. So they had their own pipeline, though. They were building their own pipeline. It was called the Baltic Pipeline. And that was a pipeline that was taking oil from the North Sea and then going to Norway, and then Norway through a undersea pipeline, again, under the Baltic, to Poland to make it cheaper. Well, ironically, the day that the pipeline, the Baltic pipeline, was going to be opened, and it was a big ceremony in Poland, President and the Prime Minister of Poland were there at the pipeline, the Baltic pipeline. There was a huge orange pipe, and they were standing there at a ceremony, and they opened it up. This was about 24 hours after the other pipeline was blown up. So, if you're looking at it from a motive point of view, they get rid of that pipeline, which was a competition for them. And all of a sudden now they, the very next day, they have their own pipeline being opened. So there was a lot of collaboration between Ukraine and Poland. Both prime ministers, the prime ministers of both countries, wrote a piece for Politico, a joint opinion piece, decrying the Nord Stream pipeline, you know, saying it shouldn't go forward. They should stop this pipeline. And Poland also was sending surveillance aircraft over the pipeline numerous times as it was being built. The Russians had a big ship there that they were laying the final sections of the pipe. And companies that were involved were complaining because the Polish were sending these aircraft over every day, these military aircraft. There was a submarine that surfaced within the restricted area. There was a Polish military ship that came nearby. There was a Polish trawler that looked like it was going to ram the Russian pipeline ship. So there were all these indications of the Polish government not wanting this to happen. And so in terms of motive, that was a pretty good motive that they had, was the all these reasons, the fact that this new pipeline was going to open, the fact that they were going to lose money, the fact that they considered this basically an act of war. At one point, Ukrainians said that once the pipeline is in effect, that will give the Russians more of an opportunity to attack us or whatever. So they had all these reasons for not wanting it open. So they had a good motive.
Yeah, just for devil's advocate, because everybody's been reading Cy Hirsch's report for weeks now, I think you established very well that Poland and Ukraine had motive and even that they had ability. You go into their use of unmanned vehicles underwater and so forth. But can the same not be said about the U.S. as well?
Right. Well, the difference here is that other than Cy Hirsch's unnamed source, there hasn't been any other indications from the U.S. And usually in something like this, there's leaks. Other people get leaks. I mean, they just, that's just the way it works.
But is there evidence of who did it?
I'm sorry?
But is there evidence of who did it? Ukrainians or Poles?
Yeah, well, you know, the way I write is I can't just go on speculation. So I can't say, well, possibly the United States did it. I don't do possibilities.
Of course.
I say that here's what we have. There's all these indications from leaks from the investigators in Europe saying Ukraine's involved and so forth. So there's a number of indications from real sources that the Ukrainians are involved, but there hasn't been any leaks from real sources that the U.S. is involved. So, you know, that's Cy. If Cy wants to tell that story, that's his story. I'm not telling that story. I'm telling this story. This story shows means, motive, and opportunity for Ukraine. Whether the U.S. helped or not, I have no idea. I'm not saying, you know, and maybe that'll come out later or not. I'm just saying that, you know, when you do an investigation, you need more than one source. And really, I always do everything for a publication. It's for a magazine, it's for a book.
Sure.
I got editors and fact checkers. And I mean, they tear my pieces apart. You know, where did this come from? Where did this come from? Where did this come from? You don't have that with Substack. Substack is like everybody going to their own little cubbyhole, writing up their own little thing and holding it out the door. It's there is no fact checking. There is no people second guessing it or anything like that. I've never lived in that life. I've always spent 10 years with ABC News. I've written for New York Times, Washington Post. Yeah, I mean, there's hardly a magazine I haven't written for. I've done 5 books. So, and they've all been very, very controversial books. So I've had numerous lawyers and numerous fact checkers going over every word. So that's why I've never had anybody.
I believe the New York
say
Times.
I've been wrong.
I believe the New York Times was speculating that Russia did it.
And that's what I was saying is that's the problem here is that the, you know, it's this whole atmosphere since Russiagate. It's always the first thing you do is you blame Russia for everything. And I blame the New York Times entirely for doing those kind of things. And the Washington Post also. In my book, I take them over the coals for what they did in Russiagate. I have a huge section on why Russiagate was such a debacle for the American press.
When you say
I'm an outsider, so I don't have to worry about that. I just write for books and I write for whoever magazine wants me to write for them.
But when you say Ukraine, just to be clear, you mean the Ukrainian government as opposed to the U.S. government's line that it was some Ukrainians, but they had nothing to do with the Ukrainian government.
Right. Yeah. A lot of times that's a euphemism for an intelligence organization, you know, a corporate operation by an intelligence organization.
Yeah.
I mean, this is too complicated an operation just for some freelancer or something. But then I get into the means in terms of Ukraine. You know, people think, oh, it's Ukraine. I mean, they're a long ways from the pipeline. Well, you know, it turns out that the Ukrainians are extremely sophisticated when it comes to undersea drone activities, undersea warfare. They've developed a undersea drone, for example, that carries 11,000 pounds of explosives. It's a, you know, this is a country that's on the Black Sea.
Yeah.
And they've been involved with Russia, this war for, you know, going on a year now, and they or over a year now. And one of the things they did was attacked the Russian ships off Crimea, and they used undersea weapons for that. So they have an undersea capability, a large undersea capability. They have one drone that they're that they have that, like I said, can carry 11,000 pounds worth of explosives. They have another one. It's one step down. It can carry 1,100 pounds of explosives. And NATO has said that the amount of explosives that were needed to blow up the pipeline was 1,100 pounds. So they've got the means, they've got the undersea capability, and they also had the opportunity. You know, ironically, at the same, just 2 months before, or I think less than 2 months before the explosion, NATO, British Navy and the U.S. were training the Ukrainians in the use of undersea warfare, drones and so forth, in that very area of the pipeline off the island where the pipeline was laid. So the Brits gave the Ukrainians six drones, a sort of a going away gift. Head of the Navy in Britain said, "I, you know, hope you do good against the Russians," or something like that. There's been a lot of talk of this yacht that was used, and a lot of the discussion about the yacht was that, well, it couldn't be used because you can't put a decompression chamber on there, and you can't bring all these thousands of pounds of explosives on there, and you need all these people with the divers and all that. Well, yeah, that's fine, but that's probably not how they did it. They did it with a drone, and all you'd need, that drone that I just mentioned that had the 1,100 pounds of explosives, is listed as a two-man drone. In other words, two people can carry it. The way that when you're teaching undersea warfare, the way you do it, put the drone next to the mine and blow it up. Well, that's the way you would blow up a pipeline. You put the explosive drone next to the pipeline and blow it up. So those are my theories about what possibly happened, and identified whatever sources I had in my article.
I wish we could continue. We've been speaking with James Bamford. We'll put links up to his articles at The Nation magazine at talkworldradio.org. We are, of all topics, failing to get to the topic of nearly causing World War III. But we do have the world's
major topic, yeah.
Dead set on getting there anyway. So go to The Nation magazine. James Bamford, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk World Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.